with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Michael Bauer, Mark Casello, Jennifer Nevins, and Chris Roebling. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv, and you can tweet me a comment at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And again, there are 18 days to go before Inauguration Day, and we have a group of people here this evening who have lots to share with you. And by the way, we should mention we are live coast to coast. So wherever you're listening tonight, this is a live broadcast. It's not in the can. It's not a best of. Hopefully, it'll be a best of the next couple of hours of your life. But we will leave that up to our guests to make that happen. There's so much to talk about. I want to begin by talking about the sanctions imposed by Barack Obama over the allegations of Russian hacking of the election. Michael Bauer, you're one of our Democrats. We got two Democrats, two Republicans tonight. What is your reaction to the this effort by the president to get tough with 18 days to go?
Well, first of all, the president waited so late in his term. He could have done this during the summer or even in the early fall. He waits until his term is almost expired. And frankly, Putin, by not reacting and not having his own sanctions, did such an end run around Obama, he made Obama look foolish.
I want to hear from our other Democrat, Mark Casella. What do you think?
Yeah, the 13-page report that was released shows that they knew of this hacking back in 2015. So I'm with Mike saying that they waited way too long and It also gave Trump an in to make Obama look foolish as well.
All right, Chris Roebling, you're a political commentator for WGN Television, amongst many other things, an illustrious Republican past and current Republican future, perhaps, depending on how well you do in the next 2 hours, Chris.
Thank you very much.
We begin the program with two Democrats criticizing President Obama, and I know that you're gonna pile on a bit, but how foolish did he look because of this?
Well, I don't think that the world takes him seriously. It hasn't taken him seriously for at least since the Syrian red line was ignored by President Obama and the United States government and the, I think, foreign policy of the U.S. and the Obama administration imploded. So I think this is sort of a poetic denouement for Obama here in the last several weeks of his administration, and it speaks, unfortunately, not just to our stature in the world, which is very, very low, unfortunately, but also I think it sort of proves up the fact that he never really understood what he was doing in international affairs.
Jennifer Nevins is our Trumpster tonight. Nice to have you with us. Congratulations on your victory last year. Is the president doing this because he's somewhat forced into it? Because there are some Democrats, including Donna Brazile, who feel that the president was not vociferous enough during the campaign to make this point to basically underscore what the Clinton campaign was saying, was that the footprints were leading to the Kremlin insofar as the release of some of these WikiLeaks information.
Right. And Obama was briefed on Russian hacking activity back in 2009. It predates anything that happened in the DNC. But yeah, what had happened when he was briefed by it, by the FBI in July, that it was going on with the DNC, his response was basically a non-response. I think it really feeds into the meme that Obama just does not like to get his hands dirty unless he absolutely feels that his back's up against the wall, and I think he feels that way now. And
does he put Donald Trump into somewhat of a box?
Yes, he does put him in a box.
What should Trump do?
I think Trump, what he's doing right now is, you know, keeping a hands-off kind of, let's not get into this right now. I think that it's
really
smart.
Let me ask you this question. What should President Trump do?
President Trump is going to take a security briefing on this next week. And the facts are going to be laid out in front of him. I think he'll make that decision then. I don't think he's going to buy into the argument that it was intentionally to put him over the top in the election. However, I don't know if they have that evidence. And I think barring that, I'm not sure what his response to this is going to be. He's nobody's puppet. We know that Trump is nobody's puppet.
Mark Costello, again, do you agree that this was maybe an effort to put Trump into somewhat of a box or not?
Well, I think the current President Obama, did succeed in this respect, that when Trump came out and said, oh, we don't really know what's happening in that internet machine and no one can really determine what's going on, I think that was an oversimplification. Certainly, when you read that 13-page document, it doesn't have all the answers. It's not a smoking gun. But it's clear that many agencies were involved documenting the source of these hacks, the nature of the hacks. So we do know. And it was just interesting to
me.
Does
it also show in your view that the Democratic National Committee was derelict in its duty to preserve their internal communications?
Certainly, like many computer users in America, people were clicking on email attachments mm-hmm. and subject to phishing scams and these kinds of things. It's a problem of cybersecurity that mm-hmm. has to be addressed.
Michael Bauer?
You know, I think the president actually, both between the Russian hacking sanctions and the UN resolution on Israel mm-hmm. and John Kerry's talk afterward, is tied together. The president is trying to show that I'm still president, and many issues that I ignored for several years, mm-hmm. I'm going to take action on, even though my term has only a few weeks left to go, and it's really ineffective in making him look, frankly, from my perspective, foolish.
How does he? I mean, he's a pretty smart guy. How does he not know this looks like? In almost a desperation move in the closing days of the administration. I mean, this doesn't help his legacy. Does anybody think this helps his legacy?
I think it actually hurts his legacy.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
I think it hurts his legacy. But I think the Russian hacking story basically, I believe, was one of a set of items that were being used by folks associated with the Clinton campaign to delegitimize Trump. And that's all failed, and I think that the hacking story is essentially now...
And to also cover their own rear end because they knew some of the things they said.
They did such a lousy job. Out. But the really hugely detrimental action, in my opinion, of the last 10 days, the last fortnight, and going into the final mm-hmm. 18 days of the administration, is what has happened with Israel. And what we anticipate will happen with Israel after the Paris conference. I think this is fundamentally destabilizing in the Middle East region.
And I would say that none of what we're seeing happening, getting involved in the hacking and pursuing this UN vote with Israel, would not happen if Hillary had gotten into office. And I think it also signals that, you know, Obama really is playing a long game here. He's going to be living in D.C. He's not going anywhere. We're going to be hearing from him repeatedly throughout the next 4 years, possibly eight, if Trump remains in office. And so I think that this is just sort of the entree into this new realm for him. He is going to be remaining a player on the political stage.
The question is he going to be the most viable spokesman for the Democratic Party as they try to move forward? I want to get Mark and Michael to weigh in on that, as well as you, wherever you're listening, from coast to coast on Border to Border on New Year's Day 2017. 1-800-723-8029 is the phone number. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast, I'm Bruce Dumont in Chicago.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much. Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through February, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, coming to you tonight from the Paul and Angel Harvey Radio Center at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Our program tonight is a radio only, so for those out in radio land, we should mention, by the way, for those that do live in the Chicagoland area, the television version of Beyond the Beltway tonight will be a different program than the one you are listening to right now. So it'll give you another opportunity to tune in tonight at midnight on WYCC or Comcast all next week and hear an entirely different group of people talking about an entirely different group of subjects. Although I think, Michael Bauer, you may be both. You may be on TV tonight as well. You're oversaturation.
The old two places at once.
Speaking of saturation, I want to talk briefly, and then we're going to get back to the trials and tribulations of the UN vote and what it means for the United States and President-elect Trump and also Barack Obama on the closing weeks of his administration. But today, Sean Spicer, most of the sort of Sunday shows were somewhat in the can with sort of generic discussions, but ABC and Jonathan Carl on This Week, they were live today, and they had Sean Spicer, who has been named the press secretary and the communications director of the Trump administration. And I have an opinion on that appearance, but I understand, Mark Casello, you saw it as well. Mm-hmm. And you and I generally are on the opposite sides of the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. But what was your assessment of what you saw from him and his performance today?
I thought it was actually an impressive performance because
I agree.
He was able to sort of turn the script on Carl.
Absolutely.
Right. And, you know, Carl thought he was pinning him down on these questions of the hack. And Carl turned it around and said, well, no, maybe it's more about the lax, you know, security of the DNC. So yeah, I thought it was an impressive debut, at least for
I thought it was too. The thing is, you know, when leaders of administrations frequently they go on these Sunday shows and they're somewhat deferential to the host because they need the host to invite them back, and that's part of the game that is played inside the Beltway, you know, media elites. And Sean Spicer was having none of that today. He didn't accept the premise of most questions. Mm-hmm. He fought back in a very never. There was no hem. There was no haw. His thoughts were clear. That he was spewing responses, not in any negative way. Mm-hmm. I think just in a guy who was really on top of his game. So if he lasts 4 or 8 years, I think we're going to have a very – if you're a Trump supporter, you're going to have a very good articulate spokesman. If the boss can't do the show – in fact, probably even if the boss does the show, Sean will be there to sort of clean it up. But I thought Sean Spicer got off to a rousing start today.
Can I just I was watching Senator Cotton on the Fox program, and then I saw a group discussion over on CBS, which was just a bunch of hand-wringing. Yeah. I mean – it was that was a place where they forgot to invite anybody who they had two Republicans, but no Trump supporters.
Oh, that's the way you define a balanced panel.
Exactly.
Now in Washington,
right?
You'll get some, you know, Romney Republican,
right,
or Bush Republican, and suddenly you're fair and balanced. But
I just want to say about Spicer, I think that he reflects something that is potentially very encouraging about the Trump administration. And I believe that is something that was actually said 2 or 3 days after the election by no less a source than Barack Obama. I don't know if you remember, but after Trump went to the White House, Barack Obama commented and said, I don't think that he is ideological. I think that he is very practical. Mm-hmm. And that could serve him very well. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell you, I think that practicality in a world where Hillary Clinton is going to take 45 minutes to tell you why a 17-year-old guy should be in a bathroom with a 9-year-old girl, okay? Mm-hmm. Practicality is darn welcome right now. And I think that's a core strength of the incoming Trump administration.
Let's talk about, on a media sense, though. One of the other practical things that happens in Washington, obviously, you know, there are some people that got reelected last year, like John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio, and they all have egos. They all love to be on television. And they know the easiest way to be on television is to disagree with the President of the United States or the President-elect of the United States. Mm-hmm. And they are already disagreeing with them. So my question to you, Jennifer, mm-hmm. especially to those Republicans that just got reelected. Right. I mean, they tried to knock off John McCain. It didn't work. Right. What is the Trump army, what are they going to be doing to put pressure on establishment Republicans or Republicans in general mm-hmm. that want to make life difficult for President mm-hmm. or President Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, the remedy that we had that we used against Cantor, you know, successfully is trying to do it, you know, at the ballot box. With McCain, with senators, it's harder to do, people who have entrenched themselves. Mm-hmm. But there are many vulnerable people out there. Kelly Ayotte got kicked to the curb. You know, there are people that we...
What about Adam Kinzinger in Illinois?
He is not liked at all in this state. He is in jeopardy, major jeopardy. There are many of us who'd rather see that seat go to a Dem, just like we felt the same way about Mark Kirk. Many of us were perfectly happy to see Tammy Duckworth take that seat over because there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the two of them. And I suspect we're going to have less of an argument from Tammy Duckworth dealing with Trump than we would have with Mark Kirk. And I think a lot of us feel the same way about Kinzinger. So I think that that's a realignment that has taken place, that we're not Republicans first.
Has Kinzinger, has he had too much of the Potomac punch? Is he sedated by the inside the Beltway media?
I sure hope not. I sure hope not. I think that Kinzinger should hew close to the rock from whence he came. I mean, this is a guy who
he's
needs...
not doing it.
I know. No. And I'm saying he needs to reverse course.
Adam Kinzinger was at the convention with me, and he made the rounds to all the Illinois parties, and he kept coming up to our table... to the women who were standing there and just pleased his punch with himself. And I asked him point blank, do you support, here I am at the convention, do you support Donald Trump? And he hemmed and hawed and said, I need to think about it. I don't know. I want to. I'm not there yet. And I'm like, well, why are you here walking around like a gadfly? And he actually looked hurt when we sent him packing and said, adios, Adam, we're here to have a good time. We don't want to listen to you. And he's like, he actually stood there and looked at me and said, but I'm on your side. I'm a Republican. It doesn't work anymore, Adam. It didn't work, Mark Kirk. It doesn't work for us that you're a Republican. That's not enough to get us there.
As the Republicans will continue to have their skirmishes, as mm-hmm. we've just discussed, let's go back to the role that Barack Obama should play. Do you want him to be the go-to guy for the media on Democratic issues, Mark?
No, I'd like to see, you know, Keith Ellison, for example, is coming to Chicago next week for a fundraiser. I know he's drawn some fire this week, I see, from my Republican panelists.
I'm sure Chris would write him a check. You support Keith Ellison for the DNC.
Oh, my Lord. Well, yeah, I mean, if he gets in there, it's great for us, so go yeah. for it.
Well, right. Remember, that's what the Democrats said about Trump being
okay,
the,
go ahead. Candidate. Go ahead. Finish your point.
But the idea is that I think, you know, President Obama, history is going to regard his legacy well over time. But now the Clinton voice, the Obama voice, I think should fade. I'd like to see a more progressive voice coming out. I'd like to see more dialogue. You know, I'm really afraid the Democratic establishment is going to do exactly what they did with the Hillary campaign and sort of pick very, very milquetoast kind of issues and talking points. And, you know, we're going to bring economic opportunity to everyone. And the progressive, remember, the Trump voters got what they wanted. They have President Trump. But on the very progressive wing, the people who were in Occupy Wall Street, for example, have never gotten a lot of traction on their issues throughout the 8 years of the Obama.
Michael Bauer, you are a longtime Democrat, active in progressive politics
yes.
here in Illinois. But in recent months, you have become more critical of President Obama.
Yes.
And now the party wants to put itself back together again.
Right.
Do you think that Keith Ellison is the guy that helps put it back together again?
I think Keith Ellison is absolutely the wrong person.
Why?
To be elevated to be DNC chair. Keith Ellison, for years, was a fan and a follower of Louis Farrakhan, who is a black nationalist racist. And to put someone in the position of DNC chair as Keith Ellison would only drive a large number of donors away from the DNC.
Mark?
And hurt the party.
So, you know, that was back in the 90s. for Keith Ellison. I live on the south side of Chicago, and the Nation of Islam is a strong institution on the south side of Chicago, and they're speaking in the communities. You don't have to endorse Farrakhan or follow his beliefs, and I don't think Ellison does anymore. He's made that clear. But I think we can't discount institutions like the Nation of Islam. They're an important play an important role on the south side of Chicago, where other people are not speaking into those communities.
But that's not telling me white supremacists play an important role in their communities. I mean, Louis Farrakhan is the same as a white supremacist, is the same as Richard Spencer to me, and there's no difference between the two.
And they're both anti-Semites. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this speaks to the fundamental unmooring of the Democratic Party because of the success of the left in taking over almost all organs of the party since 1972. I mean, I believe that this what happened in November in the electoral vote, the electoral college vote, is the ineluctable consequence of what started with the seating of Jesse Jackson's delegation in Miami in 1972. And I know this isn't a history class, and we have a history professor here, but basically, I believe the party got out of touch with the neighborhoods, to use Marx's terminology, and it got in touch and it got dependent on and it became subservient to the interest groups. And interest group politics is what took Hillary right into the shoals.
Right, and what I have a hard time understanding is when the main complaint after this election is that you lost the flyover country vote. 70,000 people lived in the Rust Belt. The solution to that is not to move more and more to the left of the party.
So then you support Keith Ellison as the DNC
chair. I would love it.
We would come back.
Do a happy dance.
We're going to ask Mark, why are the Republicans so excited about your guy for the DNC? You can answer that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels. Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. If you are driving home from your New Year's Eve celebrations and they've moved into a New Year's Day, we hope that you're driving very carefully and we're keeping you alive and alert on the road tonight. Let's go to Nancy listening to us in Dover, Kentucky on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Nice to hear from Kentucky tonight, Nancy. Go ahead.
I thought both Obama and Kerry were making decisions from moral principles, and I just wondered what your panel sees as Donald Trump's basic moral stance.
Okay, let's start. Mark, I'm going to start with you. Mm-hmm. And let me also sort of broaden the question. She mentioned, we talked briefly about the U.N. vote. Do you think the U.N. vote and the way the United States handled it was correct, in your opinion?
I read the full transcript of Kerry's speech, and if you read the text, it feels like Obama wrote it himself. It's got that language of trying to appease both sides, yet in advance a position. It's been a difficult issue, and I don't think the question of the two-state solution is any closer to a solution after the Obama administration. And you see this sort of last-minute effort at the end of multiple presidencies to sort of make some progress or move there. So I think he's punted, really, here with that abstention vote and created more questions than answers.
Chris Roebling, do you support a two-state solution?
I would support a two-state solution probably after about – first of all, the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian milieu accepting Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state where it is and defensible borders, number one. And number two, probably about 10 or 15 or 20 years or maybe longer of them purging all of the vitriol, all of the hate, all of the bias and racism out of their K-12 education system and their media and their culture and all of the things that I think have been imposed on them by being in this horrid situation of imposed, in my opinion, opportunistic statelessness.
Michael Bauer, do you support a two-state solution?
I absolutely support a two-state solution. I will tell you I'm opposed to the settlements on the West Bank, but I fervently believe that the settlements on the West Bank are an issue to be resolved at negotiation. That's not the impediment to peace.
Right.
What is the impediment to peace that Secretary Kerry failed to mention in his remarks is that the Palestinian Authority does not want to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. The Palestinian Authority twice has had a peace deal in front of it and twice has walked away from the table. And the Palestinian Authority wants a Palestinian state from the so-called river to the sea, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. Mm-hmm. What Chris was just referring to is that the Palestinian Authority takes our tax dollars from the United States, from various European countries, buys textbooks, and teaches Palestinian kids, starting at kindergarten, that the only thing a Jew is good for is to be dead. Mm-hmm. And we permit this. That's the impediment to peace.
Nancy, we're going to get to your question about whether Donald Trump has principles, and if so, what they are. But I want to give you an opportunity to respond because you mentioned that Secretary Kerry and President Obama are operating, you know, from a position of moral authority, I think is what you said. How do you feel about a two-state solution and what's happening in the Middle East and why it dominates so much world news?
What if the Israelis were to do something generous and say, here is a contiguous state? Don't you think that would have just a wonder? They could do something generous, and it would just send a message.
You know, I want to say to Nancy, they did something very generous after the 1967 war. They spent a fortune on the Sinai Peninsula, a fortune, okay? And some of that money may have been ours, but a lot of it was theirs. And they gave the Sinai Peninsula back to Egypt at the time of the peace treaty when Egypt acknowledged the existence of Israel. Mm-hmm. And they spent a fortune in Gaza for years and years and years. They gave Gaza back to the Palestinians. Michael Bauer is exactly right. Mm-hmm. It's no less than two. It might actually, if you look at it a certain way, it might even be three times. They've been offered basically 95% of what they've ever talked about in the case of 2000. And the Y River in the leading up to the closing days of the Clinton administration, it was even 97 or 98%. And they couldn't say yes. They couldn't accept the responsibility of living in peace. Mm-hmm. There's no two-state solution if one state is supremely dedicated to the extirpation of the other.
Right. Mark.
It's
difficult. Do you have any idea what it's like to live as a Palestinian? Right. Do you have any idea?
Well,
I think this is a Christian value, you know, to put yourself in the other person's shoes.
Well, I don't think
do something beyond, you know, a tit for tat.
Well, we could also.
And I think it would revolutionize the whole Middle East.
Well, Nancy, I think
Israel
we can also
did a generous thing. Mm-hmm. A Christian thing, maybe. Maybe that's the problem.
So okay, we have other people that want to respond. Mark Casello first.
So I have to agree with Nancy. I was just traveling through even the American borders over this holiday season, and the idea of going through those checkpoints every day just to do normal daily functioning is an incredibly dehumanizing experience for everyone, both the people in power as well as the people coming through those checkpoints. Secondly, you know, America's just given a $38 billion military aid package over the next 10 years. So, you know, it's hard to have any kind of honest deal coming when there's such a military might and the influence of the U.S. backing Israel. It's hard to have an honest negotiation. It's difficult, from the Palestinian perspective, to trust or believe anything that's coming.
Well, I think we have to ask also, why do they have those checkpoints to begin with? You know, when Palestinians board a bus, they're not in danger of Israelis blowing up that bus. But we have Jewish citizens in Israel who every day are faced with the possibility that a bomb is going to go off in a cafe, in a disco, in a mall, in a bus. And these things happen over and over. And when the Israelis try to protect themselves and the Palestinians lob bombs over walls and embankments at them, it poses a genuine problem, a genuine threat to them.
Nancy, I want to follow up on what Nancy's initial call was. Jennifer, I'll let you tackle it. Donald Trump's principles, what are they? Do you believe in them? Are they clear in your mind what the man stands for?
Are we talking about it as it pertains to Israel?
The presidency.
I'm assuming, right,
as a,
here.
As a human being.
Well, I think also,
in general, what would you say is a kind of moral center of Donald Trump?
Well, it's a general question. I think, first of all, there's so many people who say he has no principles. He kind of puts his, you know, finger in the wind and sees which way the wind blows, and he makes up his mind. I think Donald Trump has a very firm sense of what's right and what's wrong. He loves this country. I think he's always been somewhat of a nationalist. He views national self-interest is supremely important. I don't think I've ever heard him say anything to the contrary.
You know, Italians and Germans were patriots. You know, in fascist, you know, I don't find a moral compass.
No, in fact, I would say what we're seeing in the world today, Nancy, is a lack. We can talk about Germany today and how we have Angela Merkel, who isn't viewing her country with any sense of this is my country, I need to protect it. Nationalism is sorely missing from France and Germany and a host of other countries, and they're paying the price for it right now.
We've kind of seen the excesses of normal of nationalism in World War II.
We're not talking about World War II, though, Nancy.
Well, I think we're getting ready. I think Donald Trump is Putin's poodle.
All right, Nancy, you've shared.
We'll have gas prices through the roof. We'll have a terrorist attack. We'll have a war in the Middle East and an economic crash.
Michael,
it will be a repeat of the 8 years before Obama.
Michael, last word to you on this with this call.
You know, Nancy, I have a great deal of empathy to the Palestinian plight. I've actually traveled in the West Bank to Palestinian-controlled areas. But I will tell you, I think that the Palestinian people have for many decades been sold out by their leadership. When Yasser Arafat headed the Palestinian Authority and he died, his widow suddenly came into $2 billion. Now, what do you think that $2 billion came? It was money for redevelopment and of the West Bank that Arafat stole and sent to his widow in Paris so she could live well.
I'm sure there's corruption. I'm sure there is.
Massive corruption.
But what if Israel took a step and said, okay.
Well, Nancy, you know what? I'm not going to. Nancy, excuse me. Excuse me, Nancy. We're doing the show here in Chicago. And I want to tell you something, Nancy. You have ignored history when it suits you by saying that it's all on Israel. And then you are creating history when it, excuse me, Nancy, excuse me, you have had more than your time, okay?
Let him finish.
You have ignored history when it suits you, and then you are creating history when it's giving you an opportunity to portray some level of outrage. And frankly, I don't think you're consistent, and I don't think you're really, I honestly don't think you should be on the show anymore.
And let me pick up on that, Bruce.
Mark.
But I also have to challenge Chris on this, because Israel does display overwhelming force in these retaliatory attacks.
Let Mark respond.
For example, using white phosphorus on the Palestinian people and burning schools and hospitals in response to these rocket attacks.
14,000 rocket attacks from Gaza, and you're putting the onus on Israel.
750 women and children killed. You know, and only a handful.
So their number one issue is to redevelop Gaza, which was handed over to them as a functioning economy, and they take the money, as Michael is pointing out, instead of putting it into the economy, they dig tunnels
right.
So they can go kill civilians,
ladies
children,
and gentlemen,
women, school kids.
We have a heated debate that has broken out in Chicago because of Nancy in Dover, Kentucky. Back shortly from Chicago.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont continuing in Chicago, and Michael Bauer, you wanted to make a point because you think there may be an ulterior motive to the president for what he's doing in these closing days?
Not necessarily an ulterior motive, but you need to understand Barack Obama's personality. And when I say this, I have to tell you that I believe very strongly that Barack Obama and Donald Trump actually are very similar personalities. Let me tell you what I mean by that. They're both incredibly thin-skinned individuals. Each of them is very resentful of criticism and absolutely rejects any criticism. And third, each of them is convinced that he is the smartest person in any room in which he is in. So Barack Obama has first of all, entered office convinced that he was going to be welcomed in the Middle East as this wonderful savior, and he was easily going to make peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And when that got stymied, I think Barack Obama's just very pissed and very frustrated that he hasn't been able to do that, and he's lashing out right now at the Israelis because he doesn't like Netanyahu.
I think that there's another piece to this that some people don't want to look at, and it's uncomfortable. You know, Barack Obama was educated in a madrasa. He spent a good part of his life in Indonesia. He has what some people could say is a sympathy for the Muslim point of view. I'm not going to argue whether he is a Muslim or anything, the speculation that's gone forth, but there's definitely, he grew up in that environment. And when you have a decision like this come down, when people like Steny Hoyer and people in his own party are furious that they allowed this to go forward like this in the UN, you have to ask yourself, what is the motivation behind this? Is it truly to broker peace, or is it just he's acting out his proclivities, his sympathies?
I want to switch gears because we've gone 50 minutes in this program and we've not mentioned the P word, Vladimir Putin. Is Vladimir Putin, to what degree do you feel, Chris Roebling, that he's going to be able to roll Donald Trump?
Well, Putin is more experienced in statecraft, and he is certainly adept in all of the national means that are at the disposal of Russia, which is essentially a petrochemical state and in front of a third world disaster area. And so he knows what he's doing, and he's really he's a top player in that realm.
And Trump has outsmarted our president for 8 years.
And arguably he outsmarted George Bush as well. And Trump is a newbie. I mean, you got to say Trump is a newbie in terms of holding public office, let alone entering into the presidency. But I think that he's surrounded himself with some very strong actors. I think that Trump is well smart enough to know that Putin is not going to be a friend. He's not going to be an ally. He's a constant, continuous adversary, and he's got to be watched every step of the way. I think that the real issue, and I think that this is where this administration is headed, is over who will sell energy to China. It's China and India that are the real issues of this administration, the incoming administration. And, you know, the race is between Putin selling energy from Siberia and Trump selling energy from a revived U.S. Energy sector.
But I think you also have to recognize right now that at the end of the Obama administration, there are four significant military powers in the world: the United States, Russia, China, and Iran. Mm-hmm. And of the four, three are opposed to the United States. I think Trump realizes he's got to pick off one of those three to try to even the odds. He's not going to pick off the Chinese because they're a huge threat. He's not going to pick off Iran because I think he recognizes Iran and the Ayatollah and his mullahs for what they are. So Russia is really, truly the weak party of the four.
Right. Well, we have a common enemy here, too, being ISIS. And I think, I don't know for sure if we can't have Putin as an ally in that fight. We've certainly, you know, gotten on the side of unsavory characters before when it, you know, represented our national interest, and Trump is all about national interest. So, you know, there is some
together with Joe Stalin.
Well, right. If we're going to go back to World War II like Nancy did, we can talk about that. We do have an enormous threat. And Putin is someone who will deal with a threat like that. So there is that possibility.
Are you worried about Putin, Mark Casello?
I think we should be. I think, you know, he could potentially roll into Ukraine again and take more of the country.
What should we do? You don't like war, so he rolls in there and he decides maybe I'm going to roll into some other former Soviet bloc country. What do we do? When do you get up and when do you get tough and when do you tell your students at college it's time to go and fight for the United States against the Russian bear? Seriously.
Sure. Well, that's what NATO was for. I believe in wars with alliances, not unilateral actions. So we're moving from an era of diplomacy of the Kerry and Obama administration that was trying to think long-term sort of containment-style strategy. And I think Trump is dealing with things on an economic basis, on an exchange basis. And he's not thinking diplomatically.
Chris,
I gotta say, I don't disagree with what Michael is saying. I believe that the world being handed over to Trump is far more dangerous than the world that was handed over to Barack Obama. And I think that we all ought to be very concerned about Russia. I don't disagree with Nancy about ISIS, but I think there are bigger issues at stake. I think that, if anything, traditionally Russia has been concerned about Persia, right, and Iran, and it is a very big deal for Iran to be aligned now, relatively speaking, with both Assad and with Russia against various elements in Syria. Obama has effectively given the northern Middle East to the mullahs. This, I believe, adds texture to this point that Nancy made about his upbringing. He was raised in a madrasas, and the folks in the Muslim community in the Middle East, they know exactly who the imams were, who were related to that school, and they understand that he was part of a Sunni tradition, and he has done everything conceivable to make life horribly difficult for the Sunnis and much easier for the Shia, and it is a huge question mark and mystery.
When we come back in the second hour of our broadcast this evening, I want to continue our discussion of what legacy Barack Obama might have and also where we think that Donald Trump is going to be tested first. Is it going to be involved with Russia, or is there someplace else in the world where you think the president is going to be tested in a foreign policy challenge within his first 100 days? And then we'll look at some other things that are on that docket for the first 100 days. And if you're a Trump supporter, what is the one absolute positive promise he made to you? You will not ever let him forget. I want to hear from you. 1-800-723-2829.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while one in five children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America Nationwide Network of Food Banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, two if you're very overweight, and three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Happy 2017. This is Bruce Dumont live from Chicago, Beyond the Beltway. We are live tonight, taking your calls at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723. In the studio this evening, we have Michael Bauer, who is a Democrat. Mark Casella, also a Democrat. Jennifer Nivens, who is a Trump supporter and a big Republican. And Chris Roebling, a Republican activist and also a political commentator. You're technically the Republican analyst for WGN Television. Is that correct?
WGN, yes.
Television.
Morning News, yeah.
Morning News. And anyway, that's our group. We've had callers, 1-800-723-8289. We've got Dave standing by in Canton, Ohio, listening to us on WKBN. Go ahead, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Well, the subject has changed a few times. So
it has.
Waiting, so what do you prefer? I should not ask questions about now because
no. You mentioned my call screener said you wanted to talk about Keith Ellison.
Yeah, that was the original, but unless that's exhausted.
No. You can comment on both.
All right. Excuse my voice because I got something over the weekend. Whatever.
That's
but
okay.
Happy New Year to you. The whole thing with Keith Ellison: be careful what you wish for. Being excited about having him as someone as the front of the DNC, it's great bad publicity for them. There's a history there. Yes, that's true. But Barack Obama coming up when he was running, that was part of the same thing. They thought, oh, yeah, my gosh, socialist, Marxism, different things. This, my gosh, let this person keep going. This is going to be great. No, be careful what you wish for. But I guess I'd take a Dick Morris approach to this and say, I was advising someone, let him get there. If you want to use this strategically, let him get there. So it's enough to bring out more of the unseemly things to pull out of the past in terms of a background or vetting and get more out of what's going on with the Democrat Party, because it'll keep bringing in education caveat into the history of where the Democrat Party is when it comes to racism and other issues. And then when you tie in the stances with Israel and the Palestinian, the PLO and Arafat, you know, and Farrakhan, there's a crossover between there's Marxism, the national, black movement, but the Marxist, the Muslim or
So what you're talking about, just to kind of bring it to a head here, you're really talking about that as that if Keith Ellison should emerge, there will be a split or there will be a battle, as we had on this program this evening, between whether or not he would be positive or negative. And let me ask our partisans for their respective positions here this evening, who are maybe on different sides of the Palestinian-Israeli battle as well. Let me ask you first, Mark. Mm-hmm. What do you think happens to the party? Again, we have Republicans this evening who are gleeful about the possibility of Keith Ellison. They think that he's going to take the party way left. Tell me why you believe that if Keith Ellison led the DNC, he would lead it to a majoritarian position in an election in 2018 or 20.
Sure, because what was lacking with Hillary's campaign was excitement and energy. And Ellison, he's got a Midwest background. He grew up in Detroit, went to Wayne State, has been served and won in Minneapolis, Minnesota, so he knows the Midwest. He's going to energize people. He's got the support of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and he's carrying those issues that bring some excitement, you know, in reform of mass incarceration, public education, fighting against privatization of public schools.
And you believe that those issues, as they evolve, as he articulates them, it will make those Democrat blue-collar workers who supported Donald Trump, it will bring them back?
So, yeah, I think too much
now, will they come back because of something that Ellison has said? Or will they come back because Donald Trump will not have been able to deliver on his promises?
So I think a lot's been made of the blue-collar, white, middle-class voter and worker. There's a broader problem here that's beyond simply pegging demographics. And I think the progressive wing of the Democratic Party can be really forward-looking, which they weren't in the last election. Looking ahead, what's happening with globalization, what's happening with automation. So I think what you're going to see is a stronger message looking at a global view of the world rather than these. Trump was looking at very localized regional issues where I want to see a progressive party that's thinking about a global culture.
All right, as we focus, Michael, specifically on the battle within the Democratic Party, who leads the DNC, tell us where you think Keith Ellison, what you've told us earlier in the broadcast, right, what do you think he represents? But what's the counterpoint to him? Who beats him in a race for votes?
Well, first of all, there's a number of candidates who are running for chairman of the DNC.
Such as?
Tom Perez, the Secretary of Labor currently. I just read that the mayor of from Indiana, either Fort Wayne or Indianapolis, is throwing his hat into the ring. The chairman of the South Carolina Democratic Party. I think there's a number of candidates. I think Dave has actually made a very savvy connection between the issue of Keith Ellison and the Democratic Party and its support for the state of Israel. You know, it used to be that support of Israel was a strong bipartisan issue, regardless of whether you're a Democrat or Republican. And I will tell you, as a progressive Democrat and a strong supporter of Israel, I think there are many people like me who don't feel the Democratic Party is as strong in its support as it used to be. And I think particularly we look at what happened several years ago with the Iranian nuclear deal, and we saw the strong support for voting for the deal from members of the Democratic caucus in the Senate and in the House. We're wondering, well, where is the support for Israel and the Democratic Party going? And it seems to be lessening and diminishing by time. And Keith Ellison just adds to those worries.
Mm-hmm. That's the point that I was trying to, the caveat that there's this crossover here of what that paints a picture of, because there's bleeding into Marxist views, both the black movement and the Marxist movement, and socialism, because you're mentioning labor, worldwide labor issues. That's the world socialist movement too. You're painting a broad brush.
Mm-hmm. But how do we, I guess the question,
progressive is tied to socialism.
I want to ask Chris Roebling to offer his assessment, look across the aisle as to what our Democrats have been talking about this evening about
I think
what will happen to the Democratic Party in the future. Because I know you care a great deal about it.
I do. I was raised a Democrat.
I know you were.
And I regret what has happened to the party, but I think that I hope they go with Keith Ellison because I think Keith Ellison will exacerbate internal contradictions that are potentially going to destabilize the party. And I think that Michael brings up just one, but I think that the fundamental dichotomy in the party is the difference between these intellectual left-wing interest groups and the regular folks in America who need to have jobs and growth.
Dave, we got to say farewell to you. Thanks very much. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, more calls on New Year's Day 2017.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school. Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont continues from Chicago beyond the Beltway. Nice to have you with us. We are live tonight taking calls 1-800-723-8289. Let's go to Mike listening to us on KXLY in Spokane, Washington. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air. Happy New Year. Are you there?
Hey, everyone. Can you hear me, Bruce?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. Happy New Year to you and your guests and to everyone. First, I want to wish Donald Trump success in his presidency. He has a strong military program. His talking to the president of Taiwan was good. His pro-life position is strong. If I was going to pick trouble coming, I would pick North Korea, which will probably become increasingly more trouble with China's background support. Yet I also want to bring up the homeless in America, what will happen to them 4 or 5 years now with Donald Trump, the unemployed. The tip of the iceberg is the homeless, what programs, incentives he has for them as well. And good luck, Donald Trump.
Jennifer, do you have any idea what that answer might be? I don't think he's spoken a great deal about it.
No, not necessarily about the homeless issue, but he has spoken a lot about veterans issues and about mental health issues. And both of those issues weigh heavily with the homeless demographic. And so I think when we're talking about, you know, why do we have a homeless problem, it's also an economic issue. So it's not just a matter of giving handouts and doing something short term, which clearly has not worked to eradicate the homeless issue in this country. But when we're talking about putting people back to work, when we're talking about funding, properly funding and identifying mental health issues and offering services to the veterans, of which a good percentage of homeless people are, I think a lot of this problem in time will be alleviated under a Trump presidency with his policies.
On the subject of veterans, I am pleased that there's been some stories out that the president may just offer an opportunity for veterans to go to a local hospital, which is, again, is something, you know, when the VA scandal broke a few years ago on this program, that was something I had projected and suggested, is that why can't a vet go to any hospital?
Right.
Why do we even have a VA? Maybe the VAA should be one of those agencies that's on the way out.
I think this points up this problem that the Democrats have, which I don't think they're anywhere close to addressing seriously and honestly, because they are too dependent on public employee unions for funding and for foot troops. And that is, the public employee unions are, in fact, the reason VA is unreformable, okay? VA, Bush wanted to reform VA. I remember Bush Elder wanted to reform VA when it became a cabinet agency with Ed Derwinski, one-time congressman from the Chicago area.
Fourth district.
May he rest in peace. So you see this idea of, oh, we're going to do something, and it got so pronounced under Obama, and he sends in essentially a guy like Trump's Secretary of State. I mean, to have been the CEO of Procter & Gamble is one of the top 10 corporate jobs in the entire world. And the guy was a West Point grad. He was a distinguished veteran, and he has been absolutely on it. Why? Because you could send in, you know, St. Paul into that place, and they're not going to be able to get the union to do anything. So you have these heartbreaking stories. Like, there was one in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend about the how the spouses of our vets are being affected because they're having to pick up the slack. This is a union issue, and the Democrats will not touch any of those issues.
Let me ask this. Would there not be an easier way just to pass legislation that suggested that if you are a veteran and you have a health problem, you can go into any hospital?
Oh, yeah, I think that's where it's going.
That's the simple answer.
Here is the first piece of legislation I would like to see this Congress pass is the following. Go like this. Heretofore, or, you know, henceforward, all membership in public employee unions in the United States shall be voluntary, period. That's it.
Well,
if you do that, when Mitch Daniels did that in Indiana, 92% of the teachers union members left the teachers union. When the governor of Michigan did it in Michigan, it was about 84%. And when Walker did it in Wisconsin, it was about 87 or 88%. People do not want to be in these unions. They're forced into the public employee unions, and then their money is taken from them, and then it is recycled over to the Democratic Party.
A broader this isn't on my list of things to talk about, you know, one of the luxuries of doing this program is we really can talk about whatever we want. We generally have 2 hours, although we've got 35 minutes left. On the issue of homelessness and the homeless that we see, and we see a lot of them in Chicago and maybe in the cities where you live and are watching and listening to this program this evening, or at least listening to it. Many of those who are homeless have a mental illness. They're there for because of a mental illness. They don't want to be in a home. They feel more comfortable, you know, on the street than they could go to a mission and, you know, get food, but they don't go there. They don't take advantage of some of the things that taxpayers have made available for them and many social service agencies around the United States have made available to them. So a bigger, broader question is, when we moved away from institutionalizing those that were developmentally disadvantaged and or mentally ill, they were called mentally ill when it came out. Did we make a mistake as a nation by doing that? Would those who are mentally ill, would they be better served if we went back into some sort of an organized, institutionalized program, as opposed to what we have now, which is basically, the well intentions of the 1960s ending up with, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people on the street as part of the homeless in America. Michael?
You know, I imagine, I'm certainly far from an expert on the reasons for homelessness, but I will tell you that certainly it's a very visible issue in Chicago. Mm-hmm. We see in the bitter colds that we've had, and it's been a bitter winter so far. Numerous individuals who are homeless, sleeping outdoors. Part of the reason may be because they don't want to go to shelters, but part of the reason is also there's not enough shelters. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what we need, and I think one of the things that has been wrong with the last 8 years is we have not declared a war on homelessness. And by declaring a war on homelessness, try to deal with the various issues causing homelessness to eradicate it. It is a scandal in the United States in 2017 that we have so many homeless in Chicago.
But so many people that are out there, there is a mental illness. It could be alcoholism, yes. Whatever. And what I'm saying is, to look at the, you know, the illness aspect of it. Is there a better way to handle it? Once upon a time, as a nation, we felt that if someone needed help because of a mental deficiency, they were taken out of society. They were put into a hospital or the asylum, is what they were called in many cases. They received some treatment. The treatment wasn't terrific because it led to the reforms that led to the deinstitutionalization movement in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Is that something? Was that a better idea than we have right now, Mark? I mean, you're a left of center guy, but I mean, are we seeing the results of too much progressivism in letting people out who maybe should not be out on the streets?
I wouldn't go there. I would say, in a city like Chicago, for example, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart talked about how the Cook County prisons have become the largest mental health provider in the city. In 2012, we had 12 public homeless shelters, public mental health facilities in the city of Chicago. The mayor shut down half of those. We went down to 6. And so in the neighborhood of Woodlawn, for example, just blocks south of where President Obama lived, there was a mental health facility that was open all day, and people would actually leave their family members, their siblings there throughout the day who would receive care while they were at work. And when those facilities closed up, those people then were left, in desperate situations. Some of them certainly must have become homeless. So I think there's two things. There's also a corollary issue connected to this, which is the need for affordable housing in the country. And a lot of this has also been institutionalized, but perhaps negatively so. For example, with the Trump administration, I'm curious to see what he's going to do with the community development financing banks that were established under the Clinton administration, funded heavily under Barack Obama, trying to sort of make sure that housing remains affordable for working class people in the cities. But there's, again, it's become a big institution that's susceptible to corruption and those kinds of issues that have led to us dismantling institutions that help people.
Jennifer, we should also mention, by the way, that part of deinstitutionalization, getting rid of the big hospitals around the country, was that there was supposed to be a safety net, if you will, of community-based mental health facilities, many of which never happened because they were not funded or they were the first thing to go. So my question to you is, where do you come down on whether or not the current way we deal with homelessness is correct, or should we revisit a system that we once had and maybe just do it better?
Well, I think there were elements of the system that we once had that were very viable. But what happens when you have a huge bureaucratic system is what happens with the VA. There's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of abuse, a lot of things that happen to residents of these asylums that they had or these homes that they had. I think local control is really the remedy for that. And I think that we have a huge untapped resource for that, which would be churches who do this kind of work better than almost anyone. And what happens is when you have a church that wants to set something like this up, the government will not fund them because they're not doing it the government's way, and they have a layer of bureaucracy that the church, quite frankly, cannot afford to break through. So it causes a problem. I would love to see the government partner with private organizations to help combat this problem.
We've got to pause. Chris, when we come back, I want to get your thoughts on homelessness and whether or not we should think of institutionalizing those that are less fortunate on the streets. I'm Bruce Dumont, 1-800-723-8029. Thanks for being with us tonight.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight, we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. It was to see Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
We're live tonight on New Year's Day 2017 doing our show. Radio only tonight from the Paul and Angel Harvey Radio Studio. That's in the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago. And by the way, if you are in the Chicagoland area, next week the museum will be closed for everybody's vacation who works at the museum. So we will reopen on Tuesday, January 10th. So if you're planning to come down next week, don't do it. Wait until the 10th. Chris Roebling, you were going to make a point about homeless and whether or not we should revisit the idea of institutionalizing mentally ill.
I'm not competent to offer that opinion, but I will tell you I'm privileged to be a director of Haymarket Center on the near west side of the city of Chicago. We help a lot of people, thousands of people per year, and we're very active, and Haymarket has been very active with detoxing folks and providing a lot of different behavioral health services. So deinstitutionalization got a big boost in the 50s because of both some drugs that became available that were I think there were good intentions on everybody. I think
yes.
You had a lot of professionals who thought they were doing the right thing, and there were some drugs that they thought were going to be able to control the psychotic episodes for the folks in secure mm-hmm. psychological situations. And in addition to that, you had, if anybody remembers The Exorcist, the ward scenes for the mother of Father Karras were actually shot in a mental health ward at Bellevue Hospital. And so more people left the theater when seeing The Exorcist because of the medical scenes than because of the scenes of the mm-hmm. possession of the little girl,
right.
which were themselves pretty hard to take. But folks after the war said, we can do better. Mm-hmm. We can do better for these people. And then the mm-hmm. drugs came online. And then they thought, okay, we're going to deinstitutionalize. Right. And then by the time Medicaid and Medicare came around 10 years later, 1965, then they thought there was an enormous amount of impetus to keep people out of these residential institutions.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The net of this is now we've got bureaucracies of homelessness so that in any given year, if you take an official number of how many homeless people there are and just say, pick a city, Cleveland, and you divide the number of dollars we're spending on homeless programs by the number of homeless people, you'll find it's coming out to something like $48,000 a year, $39,000, $68,000 a year. We would be better off giving those people that cash, except mm-hmm. for the fact that many of them remain mm-hmm. profoundly incapacitated. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with that? I mean, is there some new model? I like what Jennifer says about mediating structures in society that are not necessarily government, and government taking a position of supporting different people. You know, mm-hmm. Lutheran Social Services, Catholic right. Charities, Haymarket. I mean, there are a lot of different service providers out there. We had to close one of our detoxification operations because of the entire fiscal mishigas of right. the state of Illinois. Mm-hmm. Okay, so right. we're not able to deliver services to people who need them.
Right. Right.
And so they end up in some sort of a drunk tank, God forbid, mm-hmm. At a police lockup. Exactly.
I think one of the things in looking at the history of deinstitutionalization, Hollywood did have a role because there were movies made. There was a movie called The Snake Pit,
yeah.
and that was the worst depiction of what happened. They called them insane asylums or
right.
state hospitals right. or hospitals at that point. So there was the shock, just as the shock you were talking about in The Exorcist. There was the shock of the people. That engaged the people. And then these other, whether it's the introduction of the drugs. And then you had champions in Congress. I mean, Senator Edward Kennedy was a major proponent of the deinstitutionalized movement. And that was a major point of the Democratic Progressive Party at that particular point, is that this was going to be a better way. And again, there's always, with any government program, there is unintended consequences.
Well, and
we now have 50 years of unintended consequences, and something has got to be done to improve the system because it's not working well enough, I think.
Right. And this is a problem. It's interesting what you said about here. Kennedy said, you know, let's deinstitutionalize this population. So then the population is back out you know, on the streets. But what effect does that have on society? You can look at San Francisco, and the city has turned into a no-go zone. They actually have websites where you can plot where there's concentrations of panhandlers so you can avoid them because there's violent scenes on the street. It's just like in the public schools when the government mandates, well, we no longer can have behavioral disordered classrooms. We cannot have them segregated. We need to desegregate them and put them in the regular classrooms. What happens to the regular classroom environment then? It goes right down the tubes. So I think that it's, while it's a noble idea that we want to deinstitutionalize a population, what happens to the greater society at large? There's a penalty for the other people who are living in that society. That's we're paying the consequence for that.
Is that a price that someone just has to pay, Mark? I mean, to put it in more succinct terms, there are people who work hard, who do everything by the rules, and their ability to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is infringed upon by a panhandler.
Yeah, you're going to have a hard time making me feel sympathetic for the person bothered by the panhandler. I think
did I properly state your position, Jennifer, or not? Or
I think Jennifer was talking about extreme cases where
I do, and I don't just mean someone asking for money.
If you walk down Michigan Avenue, the Magnificent Mile, if we did that tonight, we probably wouldn't go more than maybe 100 feet before we would run into the next panhandler or homeless person.
Sure. No, I think there should be institutions in place. The question is, do we mediate it through the private sector? Do we invest in those and have some stability coming from a government, you know, a local government in the city of Chicago?
But, and a lot don't want to be helped. They don't want to be helped.
There's a certain percentage because it's about personal dignity. There's people who want freedom and independence and autonomy.
Right.
And it's you know, there's got to be a way to deliver that.
They want autonomy, and they do not seem to worry that there's a loss of dignity if they're asking someone else for a handout. Mm-hmm. Michael?
Yeah, I mean, let's not, you know, deal with the issue of homelessness and from the perspective that there's one solution that will solve every homeless problem. Mm-hmm. And let's not use the terms homelessness and panhandlers synonymously.
Right.
There is some overlap, but they are very, very different situations.
Alan,
and many panhandlers are not necessarily homeless.
Mm-hmm. Alan in Austin, Texas on KLBJ. Go ahead, Alan. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Bruce. Enjoy your program. And
thank you.
Really touched a nerve. You know, I used to work with the at a mental hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And the motivation back in the 70s, the motivation for closing down the mental hospitals was economics. I mean, let's not mince words. It saved millions of dollars by closing these things down. Because when you have somebody institutionalized, you have three shifts of workers that have to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 24 hours, a 24-hour day divided by eight, you get three. So you have three shifts of people. It's very expensive. You know, we're doing the same thing now with prisons.
Mm-hmm.
The prisons are very expensive. And so now they're coming up with all kinds of ways of not sending people to prison. And they act like it's humanitarian, but the real reason is economics.
Well, economics played a part. There's no question about that. And economics are going to play a part this time.
And prisons have become mental institutions, as the sheriff of Cook County has said, and every major sheriff of any municipality or in the country would agree with that.
These are very difficult issues. I agree with Michael. There isn't any one solution that solves the entire problem. But this is I'm gonna go out on a limb. I don't know about homelessness as a big traction issue, but Republicans cannot be arrogant and they cannot become sated with this authority that's been vested in them through these voters at the state legislative level, at the gubernatorial level, Congress, Senate, and now the White House. The Republicans have got to come up with solutions, and the Republicans are going to have to face this stuff. We will see it in 3 weeks because there are very thorny issues about unringing the bell of Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to say we're going to repeal and replace it. Mm-hmm. But to get back to the national political element of this program, Republicans are going to have to think comprehensively. They're also going to have to think compassionately. How is conservatism, how is a fundamental question about the efficacy of government and government structures as they have grown under the Obama administration, how is that going to turn into both a solution to the given issue, homelessness in this case, or mental illness in this case, and also some kind of respect for the taxpayer? Because the Democratic approach to this has been grow government, make the union happy, and we'll never get around to taking care of the veteran who needs the services, but we'll always be able to announce a new commission to sort it out in the future.
Well, I just want to, Chris, I just want to remind you, when we talk about the veterans and the problems that we've had with the VA, that there may be problems with some of the employees, but much of the problem involves the leadership and management of the VA and the lack of accountability for the management of VA.
I agree.
And how few people have been fired,
right,
who have been telling their employees to fake call times and other measurements.
It is a captured agency.
Right.
It's a captured agency, and I believe Trump is going to have to uncapture these agencies so that they get back to delivering the primary benefit for which they were organized.
Drain the swamp. When we come back, we're going to talk about the promises that Donald Trump must keep if you're a Trumpster. Back shortly.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through February, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back, last segment tonight. Jennifer, I want to ask you a question. You're our card-carrying Trumpster. Donald Trump made a lot of promises, some with more specificity than others. What is the one or two promises that you heard that got you inspired, mm-hmm, that he absolutely, positively must keep or lose you as a supporter?
Well, I think the immigration issue was kind of his signature issue, and it's a huge one.
Build the wall,
and everything that goes along with building the wall. It isn't just building the wall. It's having a coherent immigration policy that puts the needs of citizens and people who are here legally, puts their
needs
first.
So if he doesn't build the wall, you're going to be upset.
I will be upset. Yes, but I also understand that that's not going to happen immediately, and I also understand this is a complex issue, and it's going to be a multi-step process. So I'm not looking for anything, oh, build a wall, poof, it's there. It's going to be something that takes time to unfold.
Do you want to see a zeroing in on sanctuary cities?
Yes.
And have federal funds pulled from them if they don't cooperate?
Absolutely. And I think that that is a huge part of this. If the sanctuary city problem is not dealt with, we're just, tilting at windmills here. You absolutely have to have that piece of the puzzle put into place there.
You're focused like a laser beam, mm-hmm, on immigration issues.
Yes, very much so. Because it's a security issue, too.
Obamacare doesn't get repealed right away.
Well, that's my second one. You mentioned two.
That's the second one. Those are big ones.
Absolutely. And the first one goes to our national security. And also the second one goes more to the economic issue. And I think that that's just it's huge. I understand, and Trump supporters understand, that Obamacare is a crippling thing for our economy, and it doesn't serve really anybody's interests.
Chris Roebling, you're an analyst. You were not a huge Trump supporter.
I was not.
To the contraire. but you are also a political operative. I want to ask you the same question. Does he absolutely have to build a wall? Is the promise about the wall, is its equivalent George Bush saying no new taxes?
I think so. I think so, and I think that's fine. I agree with Jennifer. I think that he's got to do it. I think he's got to come through on these big promises like repeal and replace. I don't think he should falter. I don't think he should question himself. I am now old enough. I'm not an old guy, but I have been around long enough to have seen several reform efforts crash on the waves on the rocks in Washington. But I also was physically a staffer in the House of Representatives in that first year of Reagan's administration. And I saw how the Reagan operation moved all of their major issues through Congress. And those 6 months of the Reagan administration could be put up against the first 6 months of the Carter administration, which was an absolute unmitigated disaster. And I'm hoping that Trump is as dedicated to what he has said and as effective in what he's about to do as Reagan was at that time.
He must not, in my opinion, he must not buckle.
Right.
The Democrats are going to try to roll him. The news media, the campaign is still on for them. They're not.
The moment he announces his budget, the Democrats will have the homeless advocates. They'll have the hot lunch advocates. They'll have the teachers. All of their constituency groups will be out there saying, Trump has no heart. The Republicans are out to ruin everybody's life. I mean, it will be a tsunami of opposition.
Well, and from the Republicans as well. I think the most I have to fear here isn't from the Democrats. It's from the people in our own party.
I think, agree with you.
McCain, Lindsey Graham. And it's going to come with the wall. The greatest opposition to that wall, I do believe, is going to come from Paul Ryan and company, who are in bed with the Chamber of Commerce and don't want to see any such wall go up. And I think that this is really going to be a fight on multiple fronts.
Which is crazy.
E-verify.
Final point. We have our immigration policy exactly backwards. We are giving green cards at the most rapid rate in the history of our country, and we're giving them to people with the lowest level of skills. And economically, in the world, what we need to do is attract people at the highest skill level, because when we're attracting the people at the lowest skill level, that is reverberating throughout our economy to hurt Americans who are already here, which Jennifer was just talking about. Right.
Michael Bauer.
Now, I recognize I did not vote for Donald Trump on November 8th.
Neither did I.
Okay. But,
didn't vote for Hillary, I can tell you that.
Well, that being said, I would think his number one priority has to be retaining and bringing back good-paying American jobs.
Right.
And I will say this in his defense, that what he did right after the election with Carrier Company,
right,
and the mainstream media picked on this issue, saying, well, you know, maybe he only saved 800 jobs or less than 1,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
Totally missed the issue.
Yep.
The issue is that the president-elect and the vice-president-elect stepped into this issue, an issue that had been ignored by the current administration for months, knowing that it was going to happen. And for those 800 or 1,000 people whose jobs were saved, they got their lives back.
Right.
And that is a remarkable, remarkable display of commitment by the president-elect.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I want to get your response to the promise that Trump, you don't like Trump at all. We know that.
Correct.
But you also are politically astute that a political leader has got to deliver to his troops. Is that a deliverable promise to be kept?
So, Trump has created the most plutocratic administration, I think, in my lifetime. And I think he's going to deliver on repealing Obamacare, but I think what you're going to see is sort of parallel agendas. I feel like you've got sort of the Paul Ryan wing of the Republican Party just waiting with their line of issues. I think you're going to see social issues back on the agenda. It feels a lot like 2006 to me. And I think Trump's an executive. And I think Pence is really going to be the legislator in chief. Trump's going to be pushing some of his big issues. But I think you're going to see a corporate tax cut. I think they've been chomping at the bit to cut that 35% down to 12 or 15. And I think that's coming. But as far as the wall, I'd say, I just haven't crossed the American border twice. you know, Trump needs to be looking forward. The carrier deal was great, but automation is coming full force, and we're going to be shedding millions of jobs, and Trump's not prepared for that.
On that note, I want to say thanks to Michael Bauer and Mark Casello and Jennifer Nivens and Chris Roebling for their assistance in being great conversants this evening. And our thanks to Chris Wick and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while one in five children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, two if you're very overweight, and three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.